This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are a lot of uneasy questions about race and identity being raised and discussed in America these days, sparked by the deaths of two black men at the hands of police officers, and more recent targeting of police officers by suspects who were allegedly angered by the treatment of people of color. Now, depending on your perspective and background, these may be conversations that have been playing out far longer than the current news cycle. Or they may be concerns or problems that you feel are fueled by the media or by politicians. But I think we're past the point where we can deny that race, racism, and identity are in the spotlight right now. Insofar as Vermont Edition is a community forum, we'd like to play that role today and have a community-wide conversation about race and about the discussions that are or need to be happening around dinner tables, at schools, in the business community, and within our formal institutions, government, law enforcement, hospitals, and healthcare centers. What are the questions about race that you're having? Where do we go from here? You can share your thoughts with us on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or call us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We've assembled a roundtable of guests to spark conversation and guide our discussion today. Here in the studio with me is Tracy Griffith, Chair of the Media Studies, Journalism, and Digital Arts Department at St. Michael's College. Tracy, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Curtis Reed Jr. is the Executive Director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. He's in our Brattleboro studio. Hi, Curtis. Nice to talk with you.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Eric Bleich is a professor of political science at Middlebury College and the author of The Freedom to Be Racist, How the United States and Europe Struggle to Preserve Freedom and Combat Racism. Eric, pleasure to have you with us from the Middlebury Studios.
Thank you.
And Sylvia Perry is a professor of psychology, formerly at UVM. She's just moved to Northwestern University in Illinois, and she studies the psychology of racial bias. Sylvia, I'm sorry you're not in Vermont, but we're really pleased to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're going to have a conversation today about conversations that are happening. We're hearing from Vermonters already in specific areas that they think conversations need to be happening, but also just about their own lives and what it's like to be in Vermont, to be in Vermont and think about race, or to be in Vermont and to be somebody who is not white or doesn't look white. Francis says, my husband is African-American. I'm Korean-French. We came to this beautiful state to start our life. We've had our share of racist comments, but we've had overwhelming support here. The love we received overshadows the hate to the point where we don't even notice anymore. Our sleepy town of Proctor has welcomed us, and we now have a forever home among the nicest people around. This community and law enforcement is amazing. But Sarah says, my husband and I are white, and our daughter is black. It's been surprising to hear quite a few locals refer to our daughter and other black people with the decades-outdated terms Negro and colored. Please call black people black or African-American. You might think it's obvious, but do not use any form of the N-word. We've heard the N-word used several times by otherwise smart and kind white people as the adjective in hyphenated descriptive phrases. Sarah goes on to describe other incidents that her family has experienced. I appreciate your comments. Tracy Griffith, let me start with you. Do you think we're having a different conversation in America, in Vermont, than we've been having in the past in light of recent news events?
Well, I think the news events that we've been seeing has definitely brought to the front conversations that have been happening in black households for generations. It's just that now it is directly on the front pages and in your nightly newscast, on your news feed. And so people who have been able to ignore the situation for a very long period of time are now being made aware of the situation.
And doing what about it?
Grumbling and complaining.
Curtis Reed, I hear you laughing. You chime in here. What do you think? Different conversations happening? Different conversations happening perhaps in some households?
Well, I totally concur with Tracy, you know, just in the sense that these are conversations that we've been having literally for generations. And, you know, through social media, through, you know, viral videos, all of a sudden, the conversation finds a broader audience. And in many ways, that broader audience is finding the conversation very difficult to have because it challenges their worldview of we live in a nice sort of society.
To what end, though, Curtis? I mean, isn't it easy still then to say this conversation is uncomfortable and I live in Vermont, I don't have to have it because the news isn't happening in Vermont. I can just feel like this isn't a conversation that affects me and my life and the people I know here.
That would be the case if we were not having such a rapid demographic shift in the United States. You know, our ability, our sustainability as a state is really dependent upon our ability to constructively engage in the multicultural marketplace that is multiracial, multilingual, multicultural. And if we cannot come to terms with how do we respond to and how do we engage the other, quote unquote, then what hope do we have for our own economic sustainability over the long time? So there is a very important self-interest on the part of white Vermonters to pay really close attention to the conversation and then how they respond to it.
Eric Bleich, you've written about this. You've looked at in your book, and we've had you on the show before to talk about this freedom of speech, how we think about things, how we talk about things, and so how we preserve our freedoms but also look at race and try to improve the situation. What are you feeling and thinking right now?
Well, my perspective is a little more focused on national debates. And the people that I know in Vermont and the people that I'm talking to in Vermont are very engaged with what's going on at the national level. I'm not sure that they see in their daily lives, which involve primarily contact with white people in Addison County, the direct day-to-day effect that some minority community members may have in Vermont. But there's a lot of conversation about racial justice at the national level, particularly policing. People are, at the national level in terms of surveys, much more worried about racial equality and race relations than they have been certainly since, I would say, the early to mid-1980s. When Obama was elected, I remember having conversations with my students about instigated by some of my students about how we were living in a post-racial America, how the election of a black president proved that America wasn't racist anymore. And my take at that time was, well, let's just wait and see. Not so fast, right? There are still a lot of racism that goes on in society, including in Vermont, that is hard for a lot of especially white people to see on a daily basis. But the experience is very different for minorities.
Sylvia Perry, I'd love to get you here in the conversation, what you're thinking and hearing and feeling about just the general tenor of the conversation, and specifically in a place like Vermont, which is, as Eric Bleich pointed out, a very white state.
Sure. I mean, I think more broadly, I have seen more white people engaged in conversations about racism as a result of some of the recent events. And I guess engaging one another in conversations, right? So not just having these conversations with their friends or people of color, but calling up, you know, younger white people, calling up their parents and saying, let's have this conversation. We never had one before. Let's talk about race. My experience with Vermonters was that a lot of people felt like they were immune from these things, that Vermont was different from other states, that Vermont was very welcoming of people of color and egalitarian relative to maybe how others were. And, you know, I think that while that may appear to be the case on the surface, there's a lot of implicit stuff going on there that's impacting people of color in Vermont. And so I think it's still, as Curtis said, extremely important to have these conversations, you know, for white Vermonters to have these conversations.
Rachel wrote us a note saying, thank you for having this conversation. It's a crucial one for every individual of every race. More and more, I am reacting to the term racism and racist. While I completely believe that systemic and structural racism is real and needs to be examined and dismantled, and that we all need to do our part, the first step for any individual is to explore their own bias and level of privilege in our society. Without understanding our own individual context and life circumstances and how we benefit or suffer from the current and past systems, we cannot begin to address these systems that are inherently inequitable and unfair. Sylvia, you've looked a lot at racial bias and people examining their own racial biases in their lives. What difference does it make if people examine that, especially white people?
So what I've found is that if people examine that, they're less likely to react negatively when they're given some feedback or information suggesting they may have biases. And I think that, you know, even though we've seen people having more conversations about race, there's still a large group of individuals who are finding it difficult to believe what they're seeing, asking, you know, with regard to the recent videos that have come out, that we should wait to see the facts and wait to, you know, hear more about what happened. So even though they're seeing these things on video, they're still not able to process this information or even able to think that this is something that could be true of themselves. And so I agree that awareness is really important, especially if people want to be able to internalize information about their biases and to change.
We are talking today about race. We're talking about racism. We're talking about biases and our culture. And we're looking at it from a Vermont angle. And if you'd like to share your thoughts with us, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Martha's on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, my name is Martha, and I'm a biracial American. My dad is African-American, and my mom is Irish white. And I've lived in places, besides living here in Vermont now, I've lived all up and down the East Coast, mostly in multicultural areas. And, you know, I've seen how people react and, you know, in a multicultural environment. And I think that as far as Vermont goes, you know, or white people, it's unless white people are going to live around black people and they're going to have black bosses, black managers, black dentists, black doctors, people, black business people. I mean, white people up here, they're never going to. They're just going to have a certain view of black people, and it's going to be negative. And until they actually live with black people like that, they can't say they're not racist because they don't interact with enough black people to say that. So I guess I'm just saying that, you know, you can do all this, you know, introspection in your head, look in your heart, look in your mind, but until you live with other people, you can't say you're not racist. I guess that's just my comment, and if anyone wants to comment on that, that'd be good. Thank you.
Martha, thanks for your call. I appreciate your perspective. Tracy Griffith, what do you think?
Well, I think what Martha is saying is that you will often hear Vermonters say, well, we don't have a problem with race, and that's maybe because you don't have people of color, right? If there's no interaction with people of color, it's very easy to say we don't have any problem with race. If everyone around you, the interactions that you have on a daily basis consist of interactions with only white people, then it's easy to see or it's easy to say that there is no problem. And I do agree with Martha. I mean, this is a big part of, you know, what's going on within the school system. It's important to have black teachers. It's important to have Asian teachers. It's important to have people of color in positions of power because then children are able to observe that and recognize that the stereotype is not limited to what they see on TV. Mm-hmm. Right. And so interactions with all different kinds of people are important. Yeah.
Curtis, you want to jump in there?
Sure. One of the things which we find that creates a certain cognitive dissonance is the fact that when we look at the data, when we look at Vermont data, we look at the youth risk behavior data that the CDC does every 2 years. We see wide disparities in the quality of the educational experience of kids of color versus white kids, or sort of the disproportionate contact between law enforcement and Vermonters and residents and visitors of color. So when you say that, well, you know, everything is going well in my camp, if you're white, then you need to ask the other camp, well, what is your experience? What does the data show? And the data is showing growing disparities in the quality of life experiences in our schools, in law enforcement, healthcare, that we cannot no longer ignore.
Tracy, go ahead, Eric.
If I could jump in here just for a second to pick up on that point. you know, if you're a white Vermonter and you live in a community that's predominantly white, you walk around the streets and you go into shops and you go into schools and talk to teachers, and you come across, you know, 100, 200, 300 people in a day, and they're almost all white, and you almost never have a conversation about race, and race rarely enters into the interaction. And so if you then meet a black Vermonter or a Vermonter of color and you have a pleasant conversation with that person and you treat them respectfully and then you walk away and go on with your day, you might think your perception would be there is no problem of race. However, that Vermonter of color also encounters 200, 300 white people a day, and it's not unlikely that they might encounter some people out of those 200 or 300 who themselves are more imbued with racism or discrimination or some form of aversion. And so their experience is going to be very different just purely in terms of the numbers game and who they see on a daily basis.
One of the things that Martha mentioned, Tracy, is that her perspective is people need to see people of color in positions of power. And if I might ask you a personal question, you are in a position of power. You're chair of the Journalism and Digital Arts and Media Studies Department at St. Michael's College. You teach students. You are the head of this department, and you present as an African-American woman. So how do you think Martha's thoughts about needing to see people in a position of power, which she says isn't reflected very often in Vermont, is that important?
I think it is important, and oftentimes it's very difficult for, you know, students who have never had a professor or a teacher of color to come into the classroom and see me there. It messes with their worldview in terms of who should be running the show within the media studies department, right? And so sometimes it's difficult. It's a situation where, you know, I've had situations where someone has come into my office and said, "Oh, you must be the secretary. Can you point me to so and so?" I've had other colleagues who've had similar situations, right? And so, yeah, I think being able to wrap your mind around the fact that there are people who present in these ways, who live this life, who are educated, who, you know, who are living here in Vermont, or people who are visiting here in Vermont, right? I associate with the Brotherhood of Skiers. It's, right? It's a group of black people who ski. Who knew, right? And the looks that we get when we appear at the mountains here in Vermont or in Maine or so many of the other white-dominated areas, it's almost like, oh, I don't know. It's like seeing a spotted, I don't know, you know, something very rare and unique,
uh-huh.
Right?
Sure. Yeah. Sylvia, let me get you in here too, because your experience at UVM, now you're at Northwestern, but what do you think? I mean, where does this resonate with you?
Well, I can say from the literature that it is very important to see people of color in positions of leadership. I mean, you know, there's a lot of data on interracial interactions and, you know, people coming into contact with one another from different groups. And what we know is it's important that if you do, if a white person does have an interracial interaction with a black person, that it be a positive experience. And if they're coming into contact with them and they're always in a position in which they perceive them to be a lower class, then that's not necessarily going to shift their attitudes and their stereotypes. But if someone's in a position of leadership, then this bubble that they have, the stereotype in their head that equals black person, may start to shift over time, because they can incorporate some different information into there that this person, you know, a black person can be in a position of leadership as well. Now, that doesn't mean it won't necessarily be met with resistance. So, you know, I've had similar experiences when I was at UVM, that students would come in to my office, which was a very small room with my nameplate on the door, and say, "Where's Sylvia Perry?" Which was always a little odd to me. It's a really small room. So anyway, you know, I mean, being a person of color in a position of leadership, you know, some of my colleagues and I have said, in and of itself is its own form of activism, because it can be very difficult and very stressful to be in that position and have people assume That you don't belong there, but we know from the research that just being there in and of itself can shift people's mindsets. So that's one thing to think about, I guess, when thinking about people of color in positions of leadership and interactions.
We're going to talk about some of the other things to think about and some of the things that you're thinking about. We're getting calls and emails from people who are thinking about these issues, thinking about race, thinking about race in Vermont, thinking about culture and identity, and putting us in the context of the wider world and the United States. And if you'd like to share your thoughts, you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Join that conversation or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we have a roundtable of guests guiding us in a conversation about race and racism in Vermont, a conversation that's been happening in some places forever, and in other places it may be a new conversation. Maybe it's a new conversation in your office or social circle. Maybe it's not. Tell us what your perspective is. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What kind of conversations do we need to be having as a whole state, having a kind of an open dialogue? You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking today with Curtis Reed, who's with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, Tracy Griffith, Journalism Department Chair at St. Michael's College, Eric Bleich, a Middlebury College professor and the author of The Freedom to Be Racist, and Sylvia Perry, a professor who studies the psychology of racial bias. And let's go to Darren, who's calling in from Linden Center. Hi, Darren. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for taking up this much-needed topic here in Vermont. As headmaster at Linden Institute over in the Northeast Kingdom, we're charged with helping our students become effective global citizens in what is the least diverse region of the least diverse state, which is interesting. But I can say quickly at LI, we actually have some diversity. We have about 20% students of color, and we have 60% students that qualify for free reduced lunch. And it's a great step in the right direction. But I noticed, as Susan, I think that was you, was talking about having people of color in leadership roles, I would sit around my administrative table with 20 other administrators, and I would see a lot of white faces. And it really got me wondering, and us as a school, an institution, questioning what we are doing. And we actually started a diversity and inclusion coordinator position this year. I was able to hire someone onto my leadership team who is a woman of color. And it's nice now to have three men and three women facing each other. We have that perspective, which helps us go down the road, I think, which is the right path. All the research is showing that teams that have diversity, both gender and diversity, are more effective. And I think that it's vital. I wanted to find out from you what you think other schools are doing and what we as schools in the state of Vermont can continue to do to just turn the corner and to become more effective at our goal and hoping to make this a better state, a better place to live.
Darren, thanks for the call. Curtis Reed, this is something that you do at the Vermont Partnership. You do work with some schools. What do you see in the landscape and what could we be doing better?
Well, let me preface that first with sort of Eric's comment and then with Sylvia's comment that, you know, adults will walk around Vermont and see very little diversity. But if you go into our schools, you know, K through 12, K through 8, that's where you see a very vibrant and diverse Vermont. And, you know, the challenge that our schools have is that our educators do not have the training and background to look at their own implicit biases as they're making educational and academic decisions. And so we're producing a workforce that is, I think someone had mentioned, language that harkens back to the 50s and 60s, Negro, colored. These are all functions of our educators who are not well-schooled themselves on issues of race.
So do they just do what Darren says, hire somebody to help? What, Tracy, I see you shaking your head. No, it
can't be left up to the diversity and inclusion coordinator to change the culture of the entire institution. It has to be a part of everything that the institution does. Meaning, what does your curriculum look like? What do your administrators look like? What do your teachers and professors look like? What does your janitorial staff look like? I mean, it has to be a part of the institution. It cannot just be this person's job. This isn't, you know, Black History Month. This is every single day, 12 months a year, right, that this has to be a part of everything that we do.
So how do you do that in Vermont, though, when, you know, I think the argument could be, great, I want to do that, but I have a pool of people in my area. I attract a certain pool of people, and they don't look diverse, or that diversity that I'm searching for isn't within this pool. What does an organization do to step beyond that sort of, it's not in that pool. I guess I don't have the opportunity.
Well, I would challenge the organization to look at where they are posting their job announcements. The city of Burlington, within the last year, just hired Brandon Del Pozo as its chief of police. Now, their candidate pool, the 20 finalists, there were 8 out of the 20 who were persons of color. 3 out of the 4 finalists were law enforcement executives of color. And people scratched their heads, well, how could that be, given, you know, that Burlington is a relatively, while it's diverse, that there's, you know, what happened there? And what happened was that the recruitment effort really focused on law enforcement officials from ethnic or racial minority backgrounds. And they were able to accomplish that because they knew that one of the things that they wanted to have representative in their, not only in law enforcement, but in terms of senior management, is diversity. So you dip your line in the pool that is most diverse.
We got a note from Chris in South Burlington who says, it's true there is institutional racism, and unfortunately it works both ways, i.e. some prosecutors or police engage in profiling, but some educational institutions, government agencies, and even private employers use affirmative action and special employment protections to privilege some races and genders but not others. This cannot be what was intended by the Civil Rights Act. Chris says it would be best for society if we just judged everyone as an individual based on their actions and not on their race at all. But we have devolved to this strange point of such intense identity politics that it's like we're living in the Balkans. Perhaps if we reinstituted the draft with a national service option instead of just military, so that we all had to spend 2 or 3 years living and working with people from all walks of life, we would rediscover that we have more in common as Americans than we realize. And let's go to Joseph calling in from Brookline. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. I would just like to say that I have a problem with the nationwide dialogue that we've been having these days. If you take events like the Michael Brown shooting or any of the other shootings that have gone on, they kind of immediately spark this outrage throughout the country before the facts come out. And then oftentimes when the facts do come out, they turn out to not be racially triggered shootings. I just feel as though a lot of people in the country are using racism, although it is a problem, they're jumping to racism as an excuse or an easy out for a lot of the other problems that we're having in the country.
Joseph, appreciate you sharing your perspective. Let's get another one in here from Wilba in Pulteney. Hi, Wilba. Go ahead.
I think the reason I called was a little different. I think having heard the last two comments, I think it speaks volumes about the problems with trying to have a conversation on race. I think depending on your race, your views of events are just so radically different. I mean, I sincerely believe that the last two callers really believe what they say, but as a Black woman, I just simply do not see the world that way. And I don't know what the answer is to get us to see the same facts the same, or at least to believe each other. When we say that as a Black person, I feel that I am subjected to racism, not only at the hands of the police, but at work, at the doctor, in all walks of my life, I see how racism has negatively impacted my health, my employment, my interactions with police officers. And I, I don't know what the answer is, because I really called in to say that I've just moved from Vermont after having graduated from UVM 30 years ago. I was in California. And I think racism is just as big an issue there, even though it is considered a multicultural state, as it is in Vermont, which has a primarily white population. And I think we just live in very segregated lives. I think statistics say that white people, like 85% of them, don't know people of another race. And I think that is why we don't get to see each other's lives up close and personal and share a common view of these events.
Do you feel like your point of view and your perspective and what you experience is discounted by, as you said, the white Vermonters who just either don't believe you or don't see it in their lives and therefore don't take your perspective on the face of it?
I won't gonna limit what I'm saying to white Vermonters. I think this is a problem. I've lived all over the country, and I think white people don't believe black people when we talk about, in general, don't believe when we talk about our experiences with racism, because they really haven't seen them. I mean, they don't go to the doctor with me. You know, they don't see me at work. I believe them. I believe that they don't see it. I don't think they're pretending not to see it. I don't think it's a problem just with Vermont. I think it's a problem with the majority of white people who, maybe I don't see what they see either, but I do believe them, you know, because I do know that our experiences are really different.
Yeah, well, but I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your perspective. Thank you for that. I'm going to get one more in here, and then let's go back to our panelists. Bob's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Bob. What are you thinking?
Hi. I was wondering if the panelists could comment on the intersection between race and class, and in particular how interactions between the races are affected by the different classes that both whites and people of color are bringing to the table.
Bob, you have anything specific you're thinking about when you look at that dynamic?
I'm just thinking that it's important and that it's a factor. It's always a factor in the equation, and that it is something that I think it clarifies things. It also makes things more complicated to talk about, but it also clarifies the conversation if that's brought in.
Sylvia Perry, what do you think about what Bob's bringing up?
Well, if I could comment on some of the previous
comments, go ahead.
As well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have so many thoughts.
Good.
first, and I'll just sort of go down the line and stop me if I'm saying too many things at once. I first wanted to comment on the discussion about diversifying institutions in Vermont. I want to say that, you know, there's not necessarily, you know, even though we know bringing in people of color and having more people of color in spaces can help potentially reduce white people's negative attitudes toward those individuals, it doesn't mean that the people of color who are there are feeling accepted and like they belong and are being supported. And so it also doesn't necessarily mean that those people of color are, you know, working toward reducing bias in the environment. So I just want to say that it's although it's important to diversify spaces, it's also important for the individuals at those institutions to value and to be on board with supporting those people of color who are there, and to not simply rely on them to shift everyone's attitudes and behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thought. my next thought was, I think the idea that, you know, let's all just get things based on our own merit and our own, strengths, it's a myth. Because what happens is it sort of perpetuates this idea that if I just work hard, you know, if I just go to school and I get good grades, because, you know, obviously I have the same opportunities to get good grades and I have the same access to information as a person of color relative to a white person, that, you know, I'm going to be able to get ahead, while not recognizing that all along the way there are various barriers for people of color. So even if I am, for example, an upper middle class black man, let's just say that. Let's compare me directly to an upper middle class white man. Let's keep class exactly the same. Let's keep gender the same. Who's going to have more access to opportunities? Who's going to be given the benefit of the doubt more often? Who's going to be given opportunities more often? And that is why things like affirmative action matter, because we know that when someone applies for college, that they get points for all sorts of things, like their parents being alum at the institution, but no one's really putting up a serious fight about that. But they're putting up a serious fight about the handful of points that someone might get because of their race or even their gender, right? White women also benefit from affirmative action. So, again, I know I'm saying a lot at once, but I just want to, make sure that, and I think one issue is that people, like Curtis was saying before, I believe, these sorts of things are really challenging people's worldviews. They want to believe that they have gotten everything that they have based on their own merits. And I think even if we were to keep class equal, even if you were to talk about a lower class white person, a lower class black person, who has more privilege in that situation and who, is going to be given the benefit of the doubt. And I'll make this one last point. I think this also speaks to policing and to situations like the Michael Brown case. Even if at the end of the day we find out that this person was truly a suspect and did something wrong, I want to come back to the benefit of the doubt thing. When, someone of color is supposedly breaking the law, who's more likely to be stopped? Who's more likely to be accosted? Who are the police more likely to pull out a gun on? And we know from the data that it is a black person relative to a white person. So I'll stop there.
Well, yeah, there is, you bring in a lot of threads, Sylvia, and it's good because there are a lot of threads to this conversation and a lot of different dynamics to talk about. And you bring up policing. We're going to go to a quick break and then we're going to come back to this question of policing. It's certainly been in the news nationally. It's also been in the news in Vermont as we look at racial bias in policing and data, that traffic stop data that's come through in the past 5 years or for the past 5 years. We'll take a look at that, more of your comments and questions as well. You can always share them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We love to have a robust conversation there. You can also call 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking about race and opening up a conversation about what kinds of things Vermonters need to be discussing, doing, and thinking about when it comes to race and racism. Are you having new conversations in your family or social circle as you watch news about racism and violence in other places? Are you thinking about situations that are or could be occurring right here in Vermont? Are you frustrated by maybe what you see as a lack of conversation, lack of awareness, lack of action in something that you've been thinking about or something that personally affects you that's been in your life for a long time? Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on our Facebook page with your thoughts. We're talking with Curtis Reed, who's with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, Sylvia Perry, a professor who studies the psychology of racial bias, Eric Bleich, a Middlebury professor and author of The Freedom to Be Racist, How the United States and Europe Struggle to Preserve Freedom and Combat Racism, and Tracy Griffith, a journalism department chair, the journalism department chair at St. Michael's College. And let's go to David, who's calling in from southern Vermont. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I grew up on the West Coast, and I just recently moved to Vermont in the last couple of years. And I will say it was a eye-opening experience. I've never seen a population that didn't have much diversity. But a lot of what some of your other callers have spoke on, I think that whites that don't have the opportunity to see diversity kind of don't understand what it feels like or what we have to experience as minorities. I think that sense of isolation, they don't understand that white privilege really exists. And just some of my experiences here in Vermont has been where my wife is a professional, where she has actually mentioned that people have spoken freely with the N-word, and the issue of Confederate flags that I find here, I've never seen Confederate flags person, but I do notice that they are in the Northeast. I see quite a bit of them in lock with the "Don't Tread on Me" flag. So when I bring that up to say white people, even all professionals, all walks of life, they have a tendency to say that, well, it's nothing. It's you. It's how you're perceiving it wrong. This is not what we are about. And when I say, well, what if it was a, you know, swastika? They'll say, oh, well, that's different. So I think in summary, I'm just, it's eye-opening, so to speak. I've never felt like I was in a fishbowl, and that's what it feels like sometimes. I'm constantly stared at, and it's, after a while, it's almost like you're living with PTSD, because you never know, what is this person thinking? Why is this person so rude, or why is this gentleman in this Confederate flag following me? So, I don't know.
David, thanks for your call. I really appreciate your perspective. Eric Blesch, I want to come back to you and, you know, pick up on any of these threads that you're hearing and, you know, where you want to take it. Because as Sylvia was saying, there's a lot to talk about and a lot to unpack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there certainly is. I guess I'll go back to the question about merit and affirmative action. And I think one way to think about merit, which is – to my mind, the wrong way, is if you are looking to, you know, attract candidates for a job or for a university, that the people who are picking who gets the job or jobs or the slots in the university can rank order from 1 to 100 or 1,000 in exact precise way the best people. That's not really how it works. Sometimes you have truly standout candidates. You have one person or a set of people that are just phenomenal, and they are clearly better than the rest. But most of the time, what you get is a large middle range of people. And I'm thinking here, let's use the example of Middlebury College, of, you know, a lot of people, hundreds of people who could do very well here. And you can't exactly know which ones are going to do phenomenally well and which ones are going to do a little bit less well. And so you have to make your guess. And you make your guess based on a number of things. But that's where, when you're guessing, you decide, okay, what other things do we want? Do we need a quarterback for our football team? Do we need a violinist for our orchestra? Do we want more diversity of certain kinds? Sometimes Vermonters benefit from that kind of diversity. Sometimes it's people from Montana or states that we get very few applicants from. And sometimes it's minorities. So in that sense, there's a pool, and you pick people based on a number of variables. One other quick thought has to do with policing. And it is true that minorities are stopped and have guns pulled on them in larger numbers. And that's, I think, partly because some studies have shown that police officers themselves, essentially when seeing a black man, a young black man, tends to be a trigger for this person may be dangerous. And that certainly is appropriate in some circumstances, but simply because they are black is not the right reason to think of somebody as potentially dangerous. So I think that gets to some of the questions about affirmative action and policing that were raised earlier.
Yeah, and Curtis Rita, you get, I think, the last word here on that. We just have a minute left, but this is something that you work on, and we do know that Vermonters of color or people of color in Vermont are stopped at a much higher rate, and not only stopped, but searched at a much higher rate, despite that the actual rate of finding contraband in a car is actually lower than for white drivers who are searched.
Right, that's true. And the difference here has to do with the way the state police has approached this particular challenge, that they've been really transparent in terms of their data collection and analysis, and they have a baseline right now, the baseline data upon which to measure, you know, how effective their changes in training, their changes in policy and protocol are, and that's the kind of leadership that we'd like to see throughout government, to say this is the data, and you know, it doesn't look particularly pretty, but it gives us a starting point to to do some proactive work.
Well, and we have done conversations on this program about policing and bias. There's still more reporting to do. I'm sure we'll be getting to more of that. And Tracy Griffith, our journalism professor, has a reading list for us that we're going to put on our webpage, right?
Absolutely,
Tracy, you'll give us that.
Yes.
Excellent. Thanks so much to all four of you for being on the program today. Curtis Reed Jr. is Executive Director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. Tracy Griffith is Chair of the Media Studies, Journalism, and Digital Arts Department at St. Michael's College. Eric Bleich is a professor of political science at Middlebury College and the author of The Freedom to Be Racist, How the United States and Europe Struggled to Preserve Freedom and Combat Racism. And Sylvia Perry is a professor of psychology, formerly at UVM. She's just moved to Northwestern University. Thanks very much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation continues. Go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, and you can share your thoughts with us there. We'd love to have more of a conversation about this. Tell us what else you'd like to hear on Vermont Edition as we continue these conversations. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.